This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best.
Morgan Stanley says, don't be fooled. There's no way to escape this bear market.
I think the right setup now is this rally will go further and it will probably drag people back into thinking that the bear market is over. And then that will be part of the signal for us to kind of press on the other side again.
Economist Vince Reinhardt says, time to buckle up.
If you had to place your money, I bet that within 12 months, the economy's in downturn.
BlackRock Investment Institute's Wei Li says the Fed won't be able to cut soon, even if the U.S. economy tanks.
We believe that they're going to hike and stay at those levels for an extended period of time.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
Had a lot of volatility in markets this week.
Right, Denise, and investors are nervous about the Fed, but they don't want to miss out on a rally either.
And Mike Wilson is chief U.S. equity strategist at Morgan Stanley. He says he's ready, Ed, for stocks to rally from here.
But he also tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Jonathan Farrow, and Lisa Abramowitz, don't expect to ride things much higher after that.
Yeah, I think he says the S&P could sink to 3,500, maybe even go down to 3,000 next year. Let's listen in.
It's not going to be easy because I want to make it clear it's still a bear market. These things are tricky, but we have to try and trade these. When you get 15, 20% moves that go against you, you don't want to miss it. And sometimes we get it right, sometimes we don't. This one we did. So we think it can extend here now. We think rates will go lower. We think, you know, Powell's commentary is right in line with what we've been saying, which is that they're going to pause probably in January. And the market's getting in front of that. And this is a classic kind of Fed pause stock market rally.
And then ultimately you think we get beaten around the head with poor earnings as we go into 2023. Now, Mike, I'm going to read you a quote, and it reads as follows. Previous lows in equity markets are likely to be retested as there may be a significant decline in corporate earnings. We're inclined to think that this market decline could happen between now and the end of the first quarter of 2023. Now, if someone gave me that quote, Mike, I'd think it was you. Except it wasn't. It was JP Morgan's Marco Kalanovich. Now, Mike, you like to be contrarian. You have been through much of this year. I have to say that view now of early 23 earnings risk is almost consensus, Mike. How are you thinking about it as we go into a new year?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, you can say it for other people too. We all try to, you know, stand out with something that's, you know, insightful or different. And you're right. I mean, our call this year now has become pretty much consensus. But that's why we flipped in October, right, quite frankly, is we felt like that call, the fire and ice call, right, Fed tightening into a slowdown, became consensus. Now we see kind of this idea that we're going to make a lower low in the first quarter. I don't think that's quite consensus yet. But I tell you what's not consensus is this tactical rally. Okay, that we watch the, you know, our competitors. We watch, talk to a lot of clients to try and get a sense for where that sentiment is.
Right.
And I would say this is one of the most hated bear market rallies that I can recall, even more so than this summer. So I think the right setup now is this rally will go further and it will probably drag people back into thinking that the bear market is over. And then that will be part of the signal for us to kind of press on the other side again.
Pushing against that, perhaps, Mike, is what inflation does, what the economy does. What do your analysts at Morgan Stanley say about the mystery of revenue growth at the top line next year? And if you get better revenue growth because of high nominal GDP, how does that redound upon margins?
Yeah, this has been an ongoing debate we've had with clients since really April. We were out in front on earnings disappointing at some point into 23. But it does contrast with this idea that we live in a nominal world. Nominal GDP is probably going to stay positive next year, even if we have a recession. You know, Ellen's forecast next year is for not a recession, but basically 0% real growth. So it's going to feel like a recession. But to your point, if you get, you know, if inflation is still positive, you can have positive revenue growth. We have that baked into our numbers, Tom. In other words, our base case of $195 next year assumes that we still have positive revenue growth of about 3% due to, you know, nominal GDP staying in positive territory. But it all comes down to margins. And this is the part of the story that we think is underappreciated by a lot of investors, which is, you know, inflation is what drove profits higher. And so as inflation comes down next year, as we're forecasting, we have inflation going back towards 2 to 3% by the end of next year. That's actually bad for equities, good for bonds, but bad for equities because it's going to crush margins. And this is the story that we think is, once again, underappreciated. The negative operating leverage that we're seeing in business models as companies scramble for supply 6-8 months ago and over hire, that has to be, you know, run through the income statement now. And that's going to be the that's going to be what makes the low in the first and second quarter. So I would say where people are maybe catching up on the earnings story, I don't think they're bearish enough in terms of this margin degradation.
Mike, you said that there perhaps could be a trough of 3,000 to 3,200 in the first quarter of next year as we do get that reality check from earnings. Have the recent data with respect to the latest CPI, with respect to some of the other metrics that people are seeing a softening in and that we're hearing a change in tone from the rhetoric of Jay Powell, perhaps, have you changed that view? Does that seem further away in terms of that bear case scenario?
Well, once again, I mean, the bear case scenario assumes we have probably a modest recession next year. And in that scenario, all that happens is revenue growth goes flat, maybe slightly negative, but that will make the negative operating leverage even worse. And so that's $180 in earnings next year. So with $180 in earnings next year, you know, 3,000 is not really a stretch. So look, we don't have a crystal ball, unfortunately. I wish I did. In terms of what I'm most uncertain about is the timing of this. You know, we thought it could have actually happened in the fourth quarter of this year, meaning these earnings revisions. And that's one of the reasons we flipped positive in October, is we felt like it's going to be pushed out. And that's what's happening. Could it get pushed out further into the middle of next year? Yes. Do we think we can avoid it? No. So we think at a minimum we'll take out 3,500 sometime in the first half of next year. And yes, that bear case, unfortunately, is alive. And that's 3,000.
That was Mike Wilson, Chief U.S. Equity Strategist at Morgan Stanley, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Jonathan Farrow, and Lisa Abramowitz.
And coming up, are we really headed for an economic downturn? And can the Fed turn on a dime? And will it really pivot?
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, we got a lot of conflicting takes this week on the economy and the Fed.
Yeah, we sure did. The parlor game of second-guessing the Fed and the markets continues.
So Vincent Reinhart, chief economist at Dreyfus Mellon, tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Lisa Abramowitz that Chair Powell's comments this week were more hawkish than some people think.
And Reinhart also says that inflation is off its peak, but he still says a recession is likely. Check this out.
There is an extremely elevated chance of recession. And if you had to place your money, I bet that within 12 months, the economy is in downturn.
I look at this, Vince, and then I look at the parlor game of the Fed, which is now different than when you were holding court at the Eccles Building. And the basic idea here is we're gaming out a rate movement higher, and then we are, quote unquote, going to figure out to pivot and guess when that occurs. Have you ever seen anything like this, or is this new pundit territory?
No. This is old style monetary policy. Right now, monetary policy is hard but simple. It's hard in the sense they have to inflict pain on the economy to get inflation down. It's simple because the strategy is, if you don't know what the right neutral funds rate is, put it at a level you sure is restrictive and then keep it there until you have demonstrable evidence that inflation is going back to goal. So if you're not exactly sure how to calibrate policy, don't. Put it at a plateau next year and just wait. That's what Chair Powell told us.
Is that what he told us, Vince? Now, did you hear perhaps a little bit more of a concession around perhaps moderating their stance in order to avoid a hard landing?
I don't get how most of the headlines came out of that remarks. He repeated his press conference characterization. We're raising rates till we get them to a level, and then we're going to keep them there. He dismissed a lot of data. Chair Powell said inflation moves around sometimes after good numbers, bad numbers come out. So I think that they would downweight the PCE price part of this. And then what he was saying was we've got to keep the pace of aggregate demand below that of trend. So so he should be worried about the spending part about it.
Well, Vincent, this is really the key point. A lot of people are saying that there is a downward shift in inflation, and it's coming at a pace that's surprising analysts, that this is good news. It's going to allow the Fed to move away from some of the rate hikes and even cut rates sooner than previously expected. Do you think people are getting ahead of themselves, that really those inputs are not declining quickly enough, and that they could even reaccelerate based on some of the rollover effects in areas, for example, like used cars?
Events always look bigger in the rearview mirror than they really are. I think there is a tendency to overweight this incoming information. Chair Powell said that, by the way. He said inflation's volatile. Sometimes after good readings, you get bad readings. He was basically telling us not to be so stressed about it. Do I believe inflation is off its peak? Absolutely. Goods price inflation has come off the boil because supply chains have been improving. And market economies work by bringing resources into sectors that are overheated. But it's spill over to service inflation. That's what you got to worry about. That's what Powell's worried about, the durable part of inflation that's still above the Fed's goal.
Vincent Reinhardt, Olivier Blanchard reaffirmed a higher level of inflation we can be comfortable with. He went from 4% in the crisis of 08-09 down to something more like a 3% level is the new 2%. Without going into the details of the Blanchard essay in the FT, is he onto something here, which we are going to rationalize our way away from the 2% level?
So yes and no. The yes part is, back in the mid-90s when central banks settled on a 2% inflation goal, it's not like they had a great conversation about the costs and benefits of that long-term goal. And we know more about problems with the zero or lower bound. And so we should have a serious discussion of what the right goal is. In the United States, it's got to include the Congress, by the way, because it's the Congress that specifies price stability. That's my no part. I wouldn't want to have a conversation with the Congress about the Federal Reserve's goals most times, certainly not in the next in the next 2 years. Moreover, it's one thing to redefine the goal when you're succeeding. It's another thing to redefine the goal when you're failing.
We call that the Bank of England.
That's just base drift. That you just can't do it.
That was Vincent Reinhardt, chief economist at Dreyfus Mellon, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Lisa Abramowitz.
So, Ed, what does all this really mean for asset allocation, you might wonder?
Well, Wei Li, global chief strategist at BlackRock Investment Institute, talked about that with Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Jonathan Farrow.
And she tells them, don't get your hopes up about a solid recovery. She also says that the Fed won't be able to cut rates next year, even if the economy tanks.
And we expect to be more constructive at some point in 2023. And having that mechanism of gauging when to turn positive is important. Sizing the damage of the macro scarring as a result of central banks over-tightening, and also understanding to what extent that damage is in the price, is going to be critical as we think about when to turn positive. And also importantly, as we turn positive, it's not going to be the prelude of a decades-long bull market that we have seen in the past.
What drives you towards making that conclusion?
It's very much around our conviction that we're in a world shaped by multiple factors of supply constraint. Yes, of course, energy prices coming down a little bit and some of the supply bottlenecks is getting alleviated. But looking beyond that, we're still facing three structural catalysts for elevated inflations in the long term. So aging demographics, over the last 15 years in the U.S., actually, participation rate went from 68% to 62%. That is wholly explainable by aging demographics. And also, we have geopolitical fragmentation that represents further supply constraint, reshoring, friendshoring, as well as the net zero transition, where we believe that there will be a mismatch between demand and supply. Even as inflation goes down, as we look at next year, we believe that it's going to settle higher versus the pre-pandemic levels.
Given that, how much conviction can you have going into long duration?
Currently, we actually want to push back against this notion that as we enter a recession, you just automatically hide in long duration bonds, because this recession is going to be caused by central banks over tightening versus previous recessions where central banks are expected to come to the rescue and cut rate. We actually don't believe that developed market central banks, in particular the Fed, is able to cut rates next year. In the face of this persistent inflation and supply constraint, we believe that they're going to hike and stay at those levels for an extended period of time.
That was Wei Li, Global Chief Strategist at BlackRock Investment Institute, with Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Jonathan Farrow.
And coming up, a close-up look at what we can glean about the economy from the state of manufacturing right now.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. Ed, November manufacturing data in the U.S. was soft, but maybe not alarming.
At least that's according to Tim Fiore, committee chair of the ISM Manufacturing Business Survey.
And here he is with Bloomberg's Alex Steele and Guy Johnson. Let's listen in.
It's soft. Definitely at 49. We're now in a contraction mode for the first time in 29 months. I think the issue, there's a big issue here around employment that we can get into too. But so demand has pretty much fallen off now. We've had seven straight months of softening demand. We're now consuming our backlog. Backlog came in at like 40, which is pretty low. So rather than working on new orders coming in, we're working on backlog, including overdue. New export orders stay weak. The new order level is at 47, not overly alarming, but consistent with trying to consume all that virtual and physical inventory that was loaded into the system due to over-ordering way back early this year. So, yeah, I think for sure we're now in contraction mode. We've broken the cycle here at 29 months. The average cycle for expansion over the last 20 years is about 34 months. But I don't think there's a lot to be alarmed here. On the supply side, suppliers continue to deliver faster. Our prices actually contracted faster this month than last month. I think we're heading in the right direction. As a point of note, 67% of manufacturing GDP is currently in contraction, which is up from about 27% back in September.
Wow. Wow. That happened really quickly.
Yeah, it did, but it's not a big fall off. I mean, 49, 51, okay. You know, 50 is the break point, obviously. You're expanding at 50.1, you're contracting at 49.9. So we're at 49, not that concerning. I've been predicting for the last two or three months that we're looking at a 48 to 52 period month to month, and we're in that range. So this is the third month at 49 to 51. You know, it's in that 48 to 52 range. It's not a big fall off. I mean, I think that's the real message here. But there's some interesting information on the employment side.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. Up until now, we've seen manufacturers hoarding labor, Tim. Are we starting to see that come to an end?
Okay, so we're still at a 2-to-1 hire to fire ratio, and that fire includes attritions and freezes. And up until last month, it was by far freezes and attrition. In the month of November, we actually had the layoff piece come into play. So of the total comments around hire and fire, and 14% of those were around layoffs. So in the prior months, it was like 3-4%. I didn't even really bother counting it back then. I went back and looked at it. So we went from 4% in September, October to 14% in November of companies actually laying off. So it's begun, and I think the last time we talked several months ago, there was concern about the moderate to long term, which is really Q1 output, and is there enough demand to support that? There wasn't really a lot of concern around finishing off 2022,
yeah.
And I think that's still the case. I think December is still going to be a pretty good month. I think we're still going to be in that 48 to 52 range.
Tim, can you give me an idea of how companies are looking at the firing part of it? So are companies anticipating they're going to have to let go more workers as it goes? Are they being really cautious in doing it, or is this kind of it?
Well, the comments I get are around layoffs and fires layoffs, and it's immediate. It's not we're talking about it next month or the month after. We're laying off now. So I think companies did take some action in November. Much better to do that than the December time period around the holidays. You don't want people to go out and drive up their credit card debt and then find they don't have a job. So I think November was kind of the month that they had to pull the trigger. Those that really didn't see a strong amount of demand in January and February. May continue in December. You know, I think still, with the demand, with companies working off their backlog and their overdue at a very large extent. I mean, our backlog number, diffusion index, came in at 40, which is pretty low. We peaked out at 65 a year or so ago. With the new order rates really being slow for the last 4 or 5 months, that's what happens. You work on your backlog. And at some point you say, okay, I don't have enough backlog here to support the headcount. It's time to kind of release them. There was a lot of comments here about trying to make sure they protected the higher quality workers. But you know, if you're going through a 2 or 3 year period of hiring, you end up having, you end up hiring people that you may not want to keep long term.
Tim, is there any way we can be sector specific in terms of where we're seeing the weakness in manufacturing? Are we seeing it in the auto sector? Is it in exports? I'm just wondering what is happening here at a little bit more of a granular level.
Yeah, so exports are still weak. Combination of the heavy currency and the weak markets, both in Europe and China. Comments still around that. On the industry sector side, we only had a couple that actually expanded of the big six. So the big six make up 70% of manufacturing GDP. The only two that expanded and didn't expand really strongly was transportation equipment, which includes autos, and petroleum and coal product, which is a refinery area. So we had computers contracting at a marginal rate. Chemicals for the fourth straight month has contracted again. That's a foundation industry that supports everybody. Machinery contracted, food and beverage contracted, but all very lightly in the 48, 49 range. So it's pretty much wide scale at this point. 67% of manufacturing GDP is in a contraction mode.
Tim Fiore, committee chair of the ISM Manufacturing Business Survey, with Bloomberg's Alex Steele and Guy Johnson.
And coming up, Lorene Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs, on her unusual way of giving away money and why immigration is one of her big causes.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, one of the most significant and engaging philanthropists these days is Lorene Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs.
She's been focusing on immigration reform, education access, climate change, and health care.
And she also uses an LLC to give away her money instead of your standard philanthropic organization.
And David Rubenstein caught up with her at her offices in Washington, D.C.
And she tells him on the David Rubenstein Show there are a lot of reasons why she gives her money quietly. Let's listen in.
So in recent years, you've become one of the largest philanthropists in the United States, but you've done largely this by anonymity. It's not well known what you're supporting generally, and you try to stay in the background, I think. So why do you try to do your philanthropy this way?
Often what happens, David, as you know, with philanthropy is that there's a lot of power that accrues to the giver, and not as much to the organizations and the leaders that are doing the work on the ground. And so I wanted to make sure that we were not the story, that we were supporting people who were the story, that the leaders and the incredible workers who are doing day-to-day work to improve the lives of other humans were actually in the front and we were in the back. And I didn't ever want there to be the emphasis on me as a donor or on Emerson Collective as a donor as much as the work that's being done on the ground. So we started off as almost entirely anonymous donors and givers. Over time, at the behest of the organization or the leader, sometimes we will be in the front. Of course, if you're supporting nonprofit journalism, that has to be publicly acknowledged. So there are plenty of times where we are happy to acknowledge that we've made a gift or a donation or support over a long period of time. But that's not how we want to lead.
So you do your philanthropy largely through Emerson Collective, LLC.
Yes, that's right.
Why do you use an LLC rather than a foundation or nonprofit foundation, which is what people typically do?
Yeah, it's true. From the beginning, I always felt that I didn't want to be encumbered by a foundational constraint. my intent was always to deploy capital as smartly and usefully as I possibly could. So to find the highest and best use of the next dollar. And so I thought I could always hold off and form a foundation if it turned out we were only going to be philanthropists as a group. But I also wanted to use other methodologies for positive social change, like investing in entrepreneurs and in companies, and perhaps using advocacy and artists and supporting movements and practices, and perhaps young emerging leaders who didn't have a C3 yet. And so I kept that level of ultimate flexibility and nimbleness, and it served us really well. I think the other issue that's really important to note is I came into philanthropy and Emerson Collective as a broader practice from the vantage point of not wanting to accumulate wealth. And so my intention is to deploy resources and assets as effectively as I can. And so I didn't need any kind of tax preference for the dollars.
So a number of the areas that you focus your own philanthropy on are, I think, worth talking about for a moment, why you're interested in them. One of them, for example, is immigration. What makes you so interested in immigration reform, and why are you spending so much of your time on that issue?
I'll back up for a second. The organization that I founded and was running in the beginning is called College Track. And I started College Track in East Palo Alto, right next to Palo Alto, California, because I had visited a high school class. I had been invited to speak to seniors who were first-generation college-bound seniors. And the entire class was from East Palo Alto. And despite the fact that they were intending to go to college, I found very quickly that none of them had taken the SATs. Very few had ever been on a college campus. We were in the fall of their senior year, and they hadn't received any guidance. So rather than have a one-time visit, I promised to the class at the end of the hour that I would come back every Friday afternoon, and I would be their college counselor. And that realization, that experience changed my life. So I started then with freshmen in high school. And by their senior year, I discovered that many of them didn't have a Social Security number. And these were students who were fully American, they were raised as American, but they were brought here as toddlers and very young, and they didn't know that they were undocumented. This was in the early 2000s, before people were talking about the DREAM Act and before people were talking about undocumented students. So I immediately started learning about immigration law and immigration standing so that I could serve the students and their families properly. And we started advocating for the passage of the DREAM Act, because what I learned was that this was not an isolated, rare case. And so we built out at Emerson Collective a bit of a much deeper understanding of the issue, but a bit of a muscle around how do we actually work with municipal, state, and federal government to try to clarify this, to try to bring some common sense solutions to this. Because every single one of us is either a direct or a descendant of an immigrant. And the whole nature of the American dream is to come here for economic and social mobility and to activate our own potential. And so for us to be blocking that for people right now in our lifetime seems like something we need to all devote our time and attention to.
Another area that you're interested in is climate change. And that's an area that many people are focused on. What do you do in climate change that tries to bring your particular expertise and interest to the subject?
We have what's invested in what's called the Elemental Accelerator, which is an accelerator for young companies who are typically between their seed and A rounds, sometimes between their A and B rounds, who need the type of capacity building and organizational support that will allow them to dig in, have further proof of concept, and raise further capital. We've had over 170 companies go through the accelerator, and they've attracted more than $7 billion on follow-on investment. In addition to that, we have our own funding practice around companies that are leaning into the new green economy and the transition economy. But then we also have a philanthropic practice that focuses on environmental justice and local communities who need to have perhaps a bridge between the state or federal policies that don't often reach local communities and who are the ones most impacted.
So when Steve became ill, eventually he decided to step back a bit shortly before he passed away. But did you talk very much about him in those days about philanthropy? Because he had not been that actively involved in philanthropy compared to what you have done.
He thought about his work in the way that artists often think about their work. And so in his body of work, he felt that he was giving some service to humanity. Steve greatly esteemed what Andrew Carnegie did. He thought the creation of the libraries across the United States was the greatest act of philanthropy because it allowed people to use their own determination and resolve and motivation to further educate themselves. So having resources and information and knowledge available and accessible to people was for him the most important thing. And so giving everyone the ability to improve their area of interest, to improve their situation in an accessible, equal way, was what he thought we should be doing.
So you were close to President Obama. I think you knew him reasonably well. Suppose President Obama had said, or President Biden said, I'd like to appoint you to a senior cabinet position, come into government, or somebody said to you, you should run for governor or senator. Any interest in doing any things like that in the government?
I do live a life of service now, and I feel like I am getting good at it, better and better each day, learning a ton. I love what I do. To stop doing what I'm doing for a different way, a realm of service would require a great deal of deliberation. It's not my intention, but I would not necessarily shy away from another opportunity if I thought this was the highest and best use of my time. I think what I'm doing right now is the highest and best use of my time.
And you've been listening to Laureen Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs, on The David Rubenstein Show with Bloomberg's David Rubenstein.
And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg.